Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 28th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us a little later in the program will be George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from our State House reporter Mike Dean and speak with WCAI environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff. Now a look at some of the news here around the Cape, the islands, the South Coast. Gwen, you couldn't look at any news media this week, it seemed, or maybe in the last couple of weeks, without being bombarded by stories about COVID-19, the coronavirus. State and local health officials continue to assure the public in our region that the risk from this is very low.
This is what people are saying, but I think the reason we're hearing so many stories in so many forums is that the story is unfolding as it's being told. You know, people are discovering things as we're going along. So it's not like they have all the answers and it's going to be disseminated in one complete piece. So that in mind, that we did have a story this week that talked to some local health officials as well as state, and we spoke with Dr. David J. Pombo, who is the medical director for infection prevention at Cape Cod Healthcare.
And so he would be the person to talk to about this particular disease.
In terms
of trying to prepare this area, or what sense that we have of how prepared we are.
Well, he actually brought that up, and he said that in terms of impact on the Cape right now, mostly what we're seeing is our institutions preparing for it. For example, there are available negative pressure rooms, which are essentially quarantine rooms, if someone were to need that. So they said they haven't seen any cases, obviously. Very few cases in Massachusetts overall, but you know, the system is preparing for the fact that it could come here. Chances are low, but there's no way to say for sure, you know.
So tell us a little bit about what we do know about this disease.
Well, one of the things that surprised me a little bit in working on this story and in Cindy's working on it was that one of the more recent finds that I was describing to you is that the mortality rate is less. The strength is less than at first thought of the virus. However, the transmission rate is higher. So essentially, to put it, you know, in one phrase, easier to catch, but, you know, unless you're in a high-risk group, probably not as threatening, life-threatening as we initially thought. And what the other thing that I think is important is that they were saying that the most important thing that you can do to protect yourself is to wash your hands frequently, try not to touch your face, because the way the virus is transmitted is through the droplets in, you know, when you cough, those droplets come out or sneeze, and also they survive on surfaces, which is a real problem because, you know, if you think about kindergarten where everybody's right coughing and sneezing on top of each other, you can also get it from the surface. So you want to keep things as clean as you can, you know, keep your hands very clean. And and they were saying also, Dr. Pombo was saying that he didn't really see a need for masks unless you were going to be with someone that you knew was sick.
You had a chance to talk to Dr. Pombo on your Facebook Live program, Life with Gwen. Did people seem to respond to that? It seems like it's such a story of the moment right now.
They did, and it definitely was. I think we had over 14,000 views as of this morning, and people are still looking. We had about 150 people watching live through the Facebook Live. So, you know, people definitely have it on their calendar and their awareness.
They're certainly aware of this and watching it to see how it may impact Massachusetts going forward. Let's talk about the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which sent a number of representatives to a meeting this week in Plymouth to try to assure panel members and the public that the radioactive waste stored at the former Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station is safe. And many who were there seemed unconvinced.
Right. There's some question about whether the visit from those five NRC officials did too much to helped very much in aligning people's fears. There were at the meeting, very specific concerns came up, and people brought questions, for example, about right now the plan is for an 80-year storage. I believe it's off Long Pond Road. In dry casks, which is a steel cask that is surrounded by up to 2 feet of concrete. Mm. And they're talking about using that system after the spent fuel rods, which are radioactive, come out of the cooling tanks, of placing them in there for up to 80 years of storage. And one of the things that community members brought up was the fact that the longest history that the NRC has with that kind of storage only goes back 34 years. So perhaps it was premature to say that this would be something they could use for 80 years.
It's definitely something that people are pointing to concerns about the fact that, as you say, this hasn't been done before. So it's all kind of being almost invented as they decommission nuclear power plants here. And then there are concerns that these dry casks, which you say are of steel and concrete, are actually sitting out in a place where they might be vulnerable to some kind of attack.
Yes, and the official said that there would be armed security around the pad, you know, the several tanks that will be out there. But, you know, it became a circular question because people are saying, well, if it's going to be impenetrable, why do you need armed security all the time? And there were concerns about that, specifically about, you know, the word terrorism came up.
Mm. So they might be vulnerable to some, if you have all this spent nuclear fuel essentially sitting up there in Plymouth, and it's highly radioactive still. It's vulnerable to being attacked by terrorists who could release it into the atmosphere. And some of the folks at this meeting, including Dan Wolf, pointing out that there's no restricted airspace over this area.
And, yes, exactly.
And also there's a line of sight to this. Some folks were saying, you know, there's a clear line of sight to these casks, and somebody could, a bad actor could want to attack them with a military-grade weapon. So a lot of concerns there, and at the same time, the nuclear regulatory folks, as you say, coming down there with five officials and kind of trying to say, oh, no, everything's okay. You don't need to be this worried. And sounds like it's still...
I think that, not to interrupt,
yeah,
Steve, but I think that as with many of the reassurances that were offered, people said, but. And,
yeah,
and there, so the meeting ended with a lot of concerns unresolved.
Hmm. And this was a meeting, just to be clear, of the nuclear, the NDCAP, the Nuclear Decommissioning Commissioning Citizens Advisory Panel. Let's move on. If you haven't gotten with the program yet, you should know that you are now breaking the law if you hold your phone while driving. And Gwen, Cape Cod Times reporter Jeff Spillane took a close look at this new law. It's a state law, and how police are putting it into action.
Well, I have to tell you, Steve, that a lot of my friends, even from out of state, the first thing they said to me last weekend was, you know, Sunday, no hands, no hands. And so
this is,
I guess,
not no hands driving, just so you
right,
know.
Right,
no hands.
Hands-free communication.
That's
in,
right.
in the car when you are the driver. And I smile because they had really gotten that strident message from, you know, these particular people from our paper. But It should be a strident message. The fines start right away. This is a strident law, and the police say $100 to $500 in fines. You know, it progresses as you get caught doing it more often, and it's such a habit that's developed over the years. So you really have to check yourself. But for drivers under age 18, all use of electronic devices, including the hands-free mode, is illegal. So they are now, older drivers are now being required to use a stand, to use Bluetooth so that you can communicate, if you're going to, with your phone through your voice.
I thought in this article it was interesting. Barnstable Deputy Chief Mark Cabral is quoted as saying, "This is probably going to be one of the biggest changes to driving behavior that we have seen in decades. And really, it's true when you think about how ingrained it is for people to kind of reach for their phone these days. And this is saying you cannot even touch your phone while you're at a stoplight. That is against the law. It's not just if the car is moving; it's if you're sitting in the driver's seat, essentially, unless you're
pulled. And
the car is on, unless mm-hmm. you're all the way off to the side of the road, stopped. Yes.
Exactly. And I found helpful in the story that ran in the paper that there's a list of what's allowed and what's not. And I actually printed this list out.
Give us a sense of what's on that list.
Okay. I'm going to read because I can't remember all of these, which is why it's printed out. So you can do anything, as we said, that doesn't involve your hands. So voice-to-text technology is okay. Auxiliary systems, virtual assistants on Bluetooth. That means you can call Siri if that's your operating system. And mounts that hold electronic devices are acceptable methods. Use of single earbuds or phone calls permitted, which is interesting. Just one, though, because they don't want you plugged in so you can't hear the ambulance coming behind you. Navigation systems may be used if they're set up before driving and mounted on the dashboard, center console, or windshield. Only a single tap or swipe to activate or deactivate hands-free mode is permitted. Some of the cars actually have it on the steering wheel.
On the steering wheel, yes.
Yeah. Which I'm now learning how to use because it's kind of important.
You have an incentive, yes.
So, and then handheld use is allowed if the vehicle is stationary and not in a public travel land. This is the one you mentioned, or bicycle lane. The law also makes exceptions for legitimate emergencies. So just quickly, what's not allowed, holding or physically supporting the device in any way, touching the device for texting, emailing, apps, video, or internet use, holding a device at a red light, as you mentioned, or a stop sign, or and as we said before, anybody under 18, you just can't use it at all.
I saw that one of the police officers in this story is saying that it's very, very easy to spot people using cell phones, especially at night, because the light sort of lights up the interior of the car, and they'll be watching for that.
Yes, and, you know, it could be my imagination, but I drive quite a bit, and I have seen a lot of police officers who are parked without radar guns, so I'm assuming that's what they're looking for.
Maybe what they're looking for. An interesting article from Cindy McCormick this week. It has to do with a local effort to boost the number of people trained to become town administrators in the future. Turns out that this may be kind of a dwindling pool.
Yes, this would offer a master's of public administration, and it would be a program that Suffolk University would be doing, it would be held. Now, Suffolk does have a relationship with Cape Cod Community College, but this particular five-semester program would meet Saturdays at Barnstable Town Hall, according to Mark Forrest, who is coordinator of Suffolk University's Cape Cod MPA program. And the idea is to produce students who are trained in managerial finances, in public, not accounting, but public administration budgeting. And
which is quite different than private business, it turns out.
Yes.
It has its own rigor to it.
And you know, when you look at the need, within the past 5 years, town administrators in Bourne, Mashpee, Dennis, Brewster, and Eastham have all retired.
So it's really trying to develop folks who can become, can fill those seats around the region where we're so dependent on town administrators in our region.
And, you know, there are several people who have gone through a program that exists now for certificate of public administration, but this would give them harder skills that they would need to actually be in those top jobs.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. Housing is such an issue across the region. Martha's Vineyard is no exception. Now there's a new residence in Vineyard Haven that will give an opportunity to some folks who can't afford market rents. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to talk about it. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, tell us about this house and who it's going to make a big impact for.
Yeah, so this house is located in Vineyard Haven, and it was a two-family home on 103 Tajmu Ave. It's been purchased by a nonprofit called Harbor Homes of Martha's Vineyard, and they're going to it's already been renovated, so they're going to have rooms for six people, six individuals in it, and they'll share a kitchen, they'll share a common room, and a couple of bathrooms in the place. And it's for people who are essentially homeless on the island. You know, we like to call them couch surfers in the local vernacular because they just have no permanent home and they can't afford one. There's really a telling quote in the story from Karen Tui. She says this is for people who have been considered too poor for affordable housing. Mm. Let that sink in for a minute. You know, these are people who, you know, rents are really high on the island. And that's if you can find a place that's being rented year round. So, you know, as you said in your opening, housing is such a big issue. And this fills a need that, you know, has been around for a long time and has been underserved, to be sure.
And the group behind it, who's put this together?
Yeah, so it's a group of housing advocates on the island and clergy, and they came together really about 6 years ago after an unfortunate incident where an individual died from hypothermia, you know, because he simply had no place to live and was living outside in the wintertime and, you know, set in. So this, you know, came about, you know, from that, this organization. And they've been working with others like Island Housing Trust, which is, you know, a developer on the island of affordable housing. They're helping to finance this in the interim with bridge loans. But community preservation money is being used. So the communities are coming together. People are donating money. And people really see the need for this type of housing. And it's really welcome in Vineyard Haven.
And while this is just one house, there's plans for there to be more houses.
Right. This is just a first step. Everyone I spoke to, you know, for this story said, you know, this is just, you know, an initial step. This is going to be for men, by the way. They still see a need for housing for women and children as well who are mm-hmm. dealing with the same issues of couch surfing on the island.
George, tomorrow is a very special day for a young woman who's profiled in a Times article. To you and me, she might appear to be 20, but in fact, she's only celebrated five birthdays. Why don't you explain this?
Yeah, so this is Ainsley Weber, and she's a seasonal resident of West Chop, and of course, she's a leap year baby. you know, leap year comes every 4 years. I actually got the idea for this story because my neighbor, Frank McDonald, will turn 17 tomorrow, and he looks a little older than 17. I hope he doesn't get upset with me for saying that on the radio, but he's a great guy. He's a leap year baby, and, you know, we've taken to celebrating his birthday in the neighborhood. We celebrate it every year, and like Ainsley says in this story, you know, she celebrates her birthday every year as well, and she just doesn't know exactly when to celebrate it. So I think she's come up with a perfect idea, which is to celebrate it all week long.
So tomorrow is the day, though, that she gets to celebrate it on her birthday.
That's correct. It's leap day tomorrow, I guess you would call it, in a leap year. And Lucas Doris, who wrote this story, gives a little bit of an explanation of why we even have leap year. So, you know, check it out. And happy birthday to Ainsley and happy birthday to Frank.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
All right. Take care.
The contention over the siting of a new senior center in Chatham is continuing. This week's selectmen made clear that they were sticking with their choice for the location. Meanwhile, a group of citizens continues to push for an alternative site. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has details for us. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the selectmen kind of doubled down this week on their choice, it sounded like, which their choice, they say, has come after a lot of consideration.
Yeah, and it's also come after some really in-depth study by a working group, which includes an architect and an engineer, which was set in motion back in January in a special town meeting. And as you said, there's a group of citizens who are unhappy with that site that was chosen in January, and that's at 1610 Main Street in West Chatham. And this group of citizens wants the town to also look at land off Stepping Stones Road, which is part of the Monomoy Middle School property. But Selectmen on Monday, as you said, they made clear that they are going to continue to support the 1610 Main Street property, and they are opposing the special town meeting article that this this group of citizens has petitioned for, which the meeting is going to be held March 7th. Now, the consultant said this week that the 1610 Main Street land has fewer issues than they originally thought, and it could accommodate a two-story, almost 11,000-square-foot senior center. They caution there are still some issues to be studied there, and they don't have any cost estimates yet. But the Stepping Stones Road proponents say the land that they're looking at would be less expensive to develop. It doesn't have any issues. It's town-owned already. But selectmen were not convinced, and they decided to continue supporting the 1610 Main Street site.
So even after the selectmen's vote, there have been new developments. Bring us up to speed. What's happened so far this week?
Yeah, there were a couple key developments actually yesterday. First, the Finance Committee voted to endorse the special town meeting article. They said they'd like to see that Stepping Stones Road property vetted to see how it compares to the 1610 Main Street property. But that land is part of the, as I said, the 32-acre middle school campus, which is, while it's owned by the town, it's leased to the Monomoy Regional School District. And the school committee last night voted that they are not willing to give up the land. They voted unanimously not to declare it surplus, which, you know, they were citing concerns over student safety due to possible increases in traffic if a senior center was built there. And also they say they don't know if in the future they may need that land for some reason. Now, this may seem to put an end to that, the petitioner's effort, but they said that they want the land studied anyway. They hope that a study would kind of take care of some of the school committee members' concerns, and they're going to, as far as we're aware, they're going to go ahead with the special town meeting article on the 7th and hope that that passes. Now, selectmen and others have expressed concern if that happens and both proposals go to a town meeting in May, one of them is going to need a two-thirds majority in order to pass to build a senior center, and they're concerned if you get dueling proposals that neither will get a two-thirds majority, and seniors who have been waiting for almost a decade for a new senior center will sort of be left out in the cold.
Just reading some of the people you have quoted in this article, there seems to be such a divergence of opinion on this and so many strong feelings.
Yeah, it's gotten to be pretty divisive in town. And, you know, it's unfortunately, it may be headed towards a sort of a town gown sort of thing with young families and school supporters being in favor of just continuing with the 1610 Main Street property and some other residents who, you know, more than 500 residents signed the petition to look at the Stepping Stones Road property. So that's a pretty good chunk of people in February to get to sign a petition. So it's becoming an interesting, the dynamic is becoming very interesting, and we'll be absolutely fascinated to see what happens at that March 7th town meeting.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for bringing us up to date on that.
Thanks, Steve.
A Provincetown building is going away, but first it's going to be the focus of a goodbye celebration. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner joins us now with the story. Good morning, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Marianne, I like this story. It really seems like it's about community in a very inclusive and positive way. Tell us about what's happening here.
It is. So an art installation is planned for what is the former VFW Hall in Provincetown. And the art installation is going to be in advance of what is, it's a town-owned building, so it's in advance of the demolition that's planned. And the installation is April 3rd through the 12th. The first organizing meeting for this art installation is March 11th. But really, what I think of at the heart of the story is, I was looking back at some other reporting we'd done about the VFW during its heyday and the use of that building, like by 1960, the members were had grown into the largest on Cape Cod. Mm. It was Christmas parties, turkey raffles, ham and bean suppers, bowling tournaments, high school writing contests. So it was really it was like the town's first real community center. So there's a lot of heart, I guess I would say.
And this building, you say in the article, it was built by the veterans themselves.
That's right. Back in 1959, they ended up getting this particular property and built it's like a 6,000 square foot building, so it's kind of huge, two-story. And so the idea is with artist Jay Critchley, who has taken on many what he considers the community itself as a surface for art. And so this is his idea, and he'll be asking people with all of their memories about the building to come and contribute that and populate the building with all of their memorabilia, I guess. So we're waiting for the first the organizing meeting to see what it's going to be all about, but it seems really like a good combination of two big ideas. So
kind of like it almost sounds like it could also be a little bit of an impromptu pop-up sort of museum-ish experience. And if people are bringing things that connect to their memories of this building, right?
I think that's really true.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen on Facebook already people are, you know, saying they had their wedding reception there, they had anniversaries, they used to sneak over with a bar that was downstairs and have Shirley Temples. So, and also back in 2012, Jay Critchley and another artist in town, they did kind of a similar idea with the old bathhouse out at the Herring Cove Beach. It was owned by the state, then now it's part of the National Seashore. But prior to its demolition, they did a whole art installation out there that was very cool and really kind of brought a lot of, I think it was like 70 artists participated in that.
Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us this morning.
All right, talk to you later.
Southeast Massachusetts continues to be the region in the state without a designated casino, though not for lack of trying by a number of parties. Joining us to talk about how this discussion may be reopened once again is Jack Spillane of the Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Good morning, Jack.
Hi there, Steve.
Jack, state gaming regulators have announced they're looking for public input on this. What does that mean and why now?
Well, it may be a baby step into getting a decision on a southeastern Massachusetts casino. As you know, there's been more ins and outs on the southeastern casino that anybody can count. The problem is that the Mashpee Wampanoags have not been able to get their land into trust. They have lost some court battles, and the latest is that they have succeeded in convincing the House to pass legislation, but not the Senate. And meanwhile, there is pressure in Brockton, where a developer wants to bring a casino to reopen the process for southeastern Massachusetts. Your listeners may remember that Region A and B, which is Greater Boston and Western Mass, have succeeded in starting casinos, but there has not been one in southeastern Massachusetts because that had been set aside for the Native Americans. With the Native American casino tied up, the State Gaming Commission is going to take some input from the public as to whether the market would bear a third casino in Massachusetts that maybe is not a tribal casino.
But then there might still be an opportunity if a third casino was approved that was not a tribal casino, and then the tribe somehow ends up with the go-ahead to build a casino, you would end up potentially with four casinos in the state and two of them in the southeast. Is that right?
That's the problem, and that's what the State Gaming Commission is trying to figure out. How are they fair to the private developers that say you've had all these years and you haven't been able to get a tribal casino, but how are they also fair to the Native Americans if they should ever succeed in getting a casino? And could the market bear two casinos? There is already a slots machine gaming operation in Plainville, which is technically part of the Southeastern Massachusetts Region C, although it's up by the Rhode Island border, almost in central Mass.
And then another wrinkle in all of this is that the playing field isn't quite level between tribal casinos and private casinos. If the tribal casino ends up as the fourth casino, it by this provision of how this was all set up, it would not have to pay taxes. Is that right?
That's right. So obviously that's a big advantage to anybody who would operate a casino. The reason for the waiver of taxes, of course, is because this is an effort on the part of the state to do something for the Native American tribes that have been disadvantaged through history. So they are able to waive these taxes if they ever get a casino up and running.
Mm. And the feeling is that this region C, our southeast region of the state, is already seeing casino business crossing over the border, going to Rhode Island and Connecticut. So the idea is to try to capture that here.
Yes, Rhode Island has positioned two casinos right on the state line, one of them near the greater New Bedford area in Tiverton. They are what's called, one of them in Tiverton is called a boutique casino. It's on the small side. The one in Lincoln, which is up nearer to Plainville, is larger. But Rhode Island is very definitely trying to take advantage of people for an appetite for casinos who live on both sides of the border.
That is Jack Spillane of the Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Jack, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Police in Tisbury are adding a new skill to their repertoire, one they say will help them do their job better. Will Sennett of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now with the story. Good morning, Will.
Morning, Steve.
Will, this has to do with better serving the island community. Tell us what they're up to here.
It does, yes. Yeah. So the Tisbury Police Department recently launched a training program for their officers to learn Portuguese. And
to learn Portuguese. That's what this is about. They're going to be learning Portuguese.
They are, yeah. And it's been added to, it's become a mandatory part of their training. So, you know, that's lumped in with crisis management drills, shooting practice, and so on. But, you know, one of the officers I spoke to told me that language and communication skills are much more used than any sort of force. And, you know, language learning Portuguese on the island can go a long way.
It sounds like there's a feeling among the force that this is a little bit overdue.
I mean, it is. It's, you know, Brazilians have been a part of the island population for a long time. So the language training, it began partly at the initiative of one officer, Carla Gomes, who is a native of Brazil. And she's lived on the island for a long time, since she was 14, actually. And she recently just joined the Tisbury Police Department from her former job as a security officer at the Agritown Courthouse. And when she was brought on, the chief asked, you know, what she thought the department could improve in. And when she said, you know, that their Portuguese outreach had been lacking, the Tisbury police chief, you know, took a step back and, it was something he wasn't aware of. And, you know, following that conversation, decided to launch the program.
And describe for us some of the ways in which the police are seeing that this can really improve their interactions with the community.
Right. So, mostly this is about, being ready in case of an emergency. You know, it's, emergency situations are stressful when police are involved, and that can only really be exacerbated when there's a language barrier. But more often than not, you know, the police aren't responding to emergency situations every day. It's really, goes down to just being pulled over. You know, that's the number one place interactions between the police and Brazilians take place on the island. And learning Portuguese, even to some extent, it can serve an educational role. For example, you know, what we're talking about later, the hands-free driving law. Laws are always changing, and it's hard to keep up, especially if you don't speak English. And, you know, just having an educational role, learning a little bit of Portuguese can go a long way in just serving the community.
let's talk a little bit about the hands-free driving law. Early in the program, we talked about it in a bigger picture. It went into effect earlier this week. The Vineyard is no exception. And you spoke to some police officers there about the kind of enforcement that Islanders can be expecting around this.
I did, yeah. So from now until March 31st, it's actually a state mandate just for state and local police to issue warnings about this new hands-free driving law. And after March 31st, starting April 1st, April Fool's Day, the warnings are going to become actually really hefty fines, surprisingly hefty.
And also there's a the other part of it is after you're, I think, in the second offense, then you have to go to a mandatory training?
Mandatory training after the second offense. So the first fine is $100, second offense is $250, and the third offense is $500 with insurance penalties attached to that.
Is there a sense on the island that this is going to have an impact?
There is, yeah, especially from the police department. That's where, you know, really they see the most hope. So the law kind of strengthens and extends this 2010 state law, which prohibits texting while driving. And a lot of the chiefs said that that law really had a lot of shortcomings and loopholes, you know, and based on that law, a lot of people began crafting their own laws, you know, maybe only check Instagram at a traffic light or a stop sign, you know. But the new law is very straightforward, very clear. Drivers may not have a phone in their hands while they're operating a motor vehicle.
Will Sennett from the Vineyard Gazette. Will, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
A lot of speculation and some demands this week about a forthcoming bill to deal with the state's struggling transportation systems. WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean was there to watch all of it, from the activists rallying on the statehouse steps to the lawmakers who did a lot of the work on this behind the scenes. He talked with WCAI's Catherine Ident about this and other news this week from Beacon Hill.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
So I said transportation system, but I think at the top of the list we could say safely is the MBTA. Why am I going to talk to you about that here on the Cape? We don't have the T. Well, because it involves a tax increase.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people outside of the MBTA area to keep in mind that, you know, Boston is the economic hub of the state, and if it weren't for the companies and corporations in the city of Boston that use the MBTA to get their employees to and from work every day, people on the Cape would have much higher taxes in general.
Okay,
Because of how the tax base works. So everyone is in this together, and I think that is really the point that Speaker DeLeo was trying to make here while saying that the combination of taxes that would be raised under this plan. Yes, it's the gas tax, but it's also a lot of new money coming from the corporate taxes, things like a diesel fuel tax, higher fees on ride sharing, and the elimination of a loophole involving rental car sales, which actually would bring in like $110 million that no one really saw coming. DeLeo's point here is that he wanted these taxes and kind of the pain here to touch everybody, not just drivers and users of, you know, roads and bridges and stuff, but those corporations that need to get their employees to and from work every day. And so that's why you're seeing this kind of broad usage of corporate and gas and everything else kind of taxes, while the MBTA does still have plans to increase fares later on. DeLeo pegged this at upwards of $612 million a year funneled into not just the T, but roads and bridges and all sorts of other transportation projects.
What did you hear from advocates and maybe even business leaders about this?
Business leaders, I think, are still kind of going over the numbers. We haven't heard too much from places like the Chambers of Commerce and groups like that. Going into this debate, though, there was a bit of a consensus that employers, the business community, knew that they were going to have to pay up something, whether or not this new higher minimum corporate tax is what they had in mind, or if they think that goes too far. That remains to be seen. I think they're crunching the numbers themselves to see if this is a fair trade-off for them. But a lot of kind of left-leaning business groups were on board with raising taxes. One thing that we're seeing is some satisfaction from the transit advocates. They're ranging from somewhat satisfied to calling it a good first step, and some are saying it's just not big enough. So liberals on Beacon Hill are now looking at where they can up the ante a little bit.
Okay. I want to look over at the Senate, which has been talking about transportation issues. This was a House package, but they're talking about it as well over in the Senate. And some Republicans are worried that with the T, there are some liabilities that if they don't address them, they are going to need to throw even more money at the system than they're already talking about now.
Yeah, Republicans are using the opportunity of this tax talk and this kind of transportation reform debate to talk about the MBTA's pension system, which is something that is privately run, and there's an expectation that it can't sustain itself, that it's just performing poorly, and it won't be able to meet the benefits for all of the 6,800 retirees that are under this system. And the fear here is that if the MBTA pension system goes under, it's the T itself that's going to be responsible for all pensions. For all those benefits, which means it's going to be the state, which means it's going to be the taxpayers. So Republicans are trying to push some reforms on the MBTA pension plan, almost instead of having it private, to make it public, bring it under the auspices of other state pension plans, the way they operate, which is fairly successfully, and to give oversight in different roles. Because right now, a lot of state leaders don't actually know what those pension liabilities are and what the MBTA might actually be on the hook for if it fails. So the Republicans in the Senate have a bill that would make a task force, analyze that, and potentially bring it under state control.
This isn't all about the MBTA, Mike. Some of the money raised would go toward fixing roads and bridges, right?
Yeah, not only roads and bridges, but, you know, the RTAs, the regional transportation authorities, things like the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, you know, the buses that you see around. That was kind of critical for this bill to go forward. And I think it's something that you're going to see a lot of talk on as this bill gets taken up. Because, it's not just the MBTA that's going to be getting this money. In order to get, you know, rural or suburban lawmakers to sign off on a gas tax hike like this, you got to be able to tell them, hey, look, your district is also going to be affected by this. You're going to get that new highway pavement or bridge fix that you've been looking for, that kind of a thing.
And there is some sentiment in favor of this. Activists were on Beacon Hill this week urging lawmakers to do just this, raise the taxes.
There are plenty of activists around here who say that, you know, this $612 million isn't going to be enough. A lot of that is because the leadership, DeLeo and his team, haven't really laid out their spending priorities. They've said how they're going to raise the money and where they're going to put it into this transportation fund. But what they haven't done is list out, and this is going to go for this, and this much money is going to go to this annually, and all this kind of stuff. That could come about in the budget and in the transportation bond bill. That are two things that are a little bit down the road here. But yeah, what we're hearing from activists who are saying, you know, this just isn't enough. The day before that this bill came out, the Red Line was shooting flames out through Broadway Station.
Oh, man.
Literally. The basic thinking here is instead of, you know, a half a billion, $600 million to fix the MBTA and give it, you know, moderately better service, go for a billion, go for, you know, a completely new and enhanced service, far more ambitious ideas to going forward to not just fix what we got, but improve it for the next 50 years.
In other news, the governor's side of things, he unveiled a big state police reform bill this week. And this comes amid what has been kind of an evolving scandal over the past few years where, you know, we've been learning of state police officers who have claimed overtime for shifts they haven't worked, and there's been other problems. What's the big takeaway from Baker's proposal?
Baker's bill would really reform a lot of what is happening in the state police. It would let superiors crack down on and suspend troopers a little more easily. It would let the state and cities and towns kind of recoup money if it was fraudulently filed, things like that. And one note, it would allow the head of the state police, the superintendent, to come from outside of the state police ranks, which right now by law, it has to be a current trooper. And that's seen as a kind of a cultural shift for the next superintendent.
And just really briefly, House Speaker Robert DeLeo and Senate President Karen Spilka don't often see eye to eye on things, but they agree on one thing, and that is who they support for the next president.
Yeah, Karen Spilka has been behind Elizabeth Warren the whole time here, and Bob DeLeo just came out and said that he's also going to support Senator Warren. He says that she's the best one qualified to be the next president of the U.S.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean, reporting to us from Beacon Hill, as he does most weeks. Mike, have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks a lot.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. This spring, Cape Cod residents in all 15 towns may get a chance to vote on town meeting articles declaring a climate emergency. With us in the studio to explain what it's all about, WCAI's reporter for climate and environment, Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Tell us what a declaration of a climate emergency actually does.
Yeah, well, it
doesn't do anything specifically. It's basically towns acknowledging, you know, climate change is a man-made existential threat to our community. And there's no concrete plans that come with it. But communities then would be directed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero at, quote, the earliest technically and economically feasible time. So that's things like, you know, if you're building a new police station, does that police station have solar panels if it can? If you're getting a new town fleet, is that fleet of electric cars instead of gas-powered cars? So it's making those kinds of decisions and building them into the town officials and department structure.
It's kind of a declaration of intention as they go about business going forward, I would assume.
Exactly. It doesn't cost towns anything specifically.
This has also been a conversation at the national level. You reported this week about former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who was in Woods Hole this week because he's running against President Trump for the 2020 presidential primaries. He was talking about the climate, too.
That's right. That's right. And really, that's one of the major platforms that he's running on to distinguish himself from President Trump. You know, he came to Woods Hole Research Center. He's one of four presidential candidates who's spoken to scientists at the center. And he said, you know, tell me about carbon capture. That's actually drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. Tell me about farming techniques that can do that even better. That's one way he really wants to stand out. And we know as Massachusetts governor, he did really prioritize environmental protections. He jumped into the Charles River after signing an act to protect rivers and creeks from development. He jumped in all his clothes, as many people may remember, in the 90s. And he's trying to carry that forward into his presidency.
I want to pivot here in the last couple of minutes of the program and talk about endangered North Atlantic right whales, which you also did some reporting on this week. And we just got some news right now as you were coming in about an endangered right whale that's been spotted entangled off the coast of Nantucket.
That's right. This is a 19-year-old female named Dragon. She's entangled in fishing gear, according to the New England Aquarium. There's a buoy lodged in the right side of her mouth that's preventing it from closing. She's emaciated, gray, and there seems to be an injury on her head because it's the aerial teams are seeing orange spots, which are these kind of lice that gather around infested and infected skin.
Mm. So a couple of things about this that really make it stand out. One of them, it's right in our waters.
That's
it's
right.
An entanglement that sounds like it's very serious. And then this is a 19-year-old female, which means that she is in the prime of her reproductive age.
That's exactly right. She has had three calves, which is pretty incredible given the stressors to this species. One of them it seems to be alive. The other two, one is certainly not. The other one we're not quite sure about. But this is a female that could go on reproducing for the next 20, 30 years. And this is a species that we actually don't, in the last 50 years, we haven't seen what kills them other than humans. Mm. So this is a female that could otherwise continue reproducing for this species that's otherwise dwindling to population around 400. This could be a huge loss.
And very briefly, Canada imposed some new rules this week that may help the right whales up in Canadian waters.
That's right. I mean, this news of this entangled and gravely injured whale is really brutal to hear because Canada just unveiled a bunch of new regulations, including speed restrictions, gear modifications, closures in some parts of their waters. But it seems to not have come soon enough.
Eve Zuckoff, WCAI's climate and environment reporter. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
That's what's been happening around the Cape, the Islands, South Coast this week. I want to thank my guest, Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. I spoke with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times. We heard from Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette, Mike Dean up at the State House. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.